Hello everyone and welcome to Don't Ignore the Elephant, the podcast where we talk about the stuff that no one else will, the elephant in the room. I'm Liz O'Riordan. I'm a breast cancer surgeon with breast cancer myself, and during my career I've had a lot of elephants to deal with. I've learned that talking about them, getting them out in the open, can help you know that you're not alone. And it's wonderful that we're building a community of people who want to talk about their elephants. Keep sharing them with me, because together we can help each other. Whether it's cancer, grief, resilience or bullying, losing your identity, or simply how to get out of bed in the morning, there are loads of things that can be hard to discuss. I know how powerful it can be to hear someone else talk honestly about their own problems. I've carefully chosen my guests to help get these issues on the table. They've either experienced the elephant themselves or spent their life helping those of us who have them. I'm going to be asking the questions everyone else is too afraid to ask. This week, we're going to be talking all about masculinity and mental health. Now, I've talked openly about my own mental health, which is pretty rare in the medical community. It was really scary to admit I'd had severe depression. I thought it was my fault, that I should have been able to cope. And I know I'm not alone. More and more people are now opening up, but most of them are female. Why is that? Do men not have mental health problems? Or is it that they don't feel safe to talk about it? And why is it so unsettling to watch a grown man cry? This week's guest wants to crack open our opinion of masculinity and mental health. He says that men are meant to cry, both on and off the sports pitch. Alex Hewitt founded AOK Events, a leading event management agency, over 21 years ago. They count some of the world's leading brands as long-term clients. In 2020, he had over 50 staff, many of whom were now friends. But when the global pandemic hit, Alex, like many others, was faced with his business being shut down overnight. He was forced to make some incredibly difficult decisions that he knew would affect the lives of his employees, and he's had to live with those consequences. He's spoken before about how he dealt with the aftershock and found a way to keep going, and I can totally relate to this, as I was forced to retire when my cancer came back, and I can't wait to hear how he coped. Welcome, Alex, to the podcast.
It's lovely to be here.
Thank you. I think it's fair to say that COVID has had a huge effect on all our lives. When the pandemic hit, did you have any sense of what was to come?
I think, was the only person at AOK Events in February 2020 that was really worried about it. Mm-hmm. We had an off-site, company off-site, parties, fancy dress, typical agency fun. And I stood up and said that I was really, really worried. And I kind of got laughed down by lots of people in the room that it was not something that was going to affect us particularly.
And had it hit England yet? I can't remember.
No, there were one or two cases, but nothing else. And to think that, I mean, less than a month after that, and we all listened to the Prime Minister, you know, address us all in the only thing that can be similar to what maybe, you know, our grandparents endured with, you know, Churchill back in the Second World War. We haven't had a moment where we've all had to listen to the radios or the TVs and to be told, if you can, you know, lay down your pens, lay down your pencils, you know, you're just going to have to go home from work. That was an extraordinary day.
Yeah. How was your business affected?
It was decimated. Of all of the careers and all of the agencies to own, owning and running a company that specialised in the mass gatherings of people in a pandemic, that was terrible. I mean, what a terrible business to have. During a pandemic, we kind of sent everyone at home, and for the first week or two, we just looked at the news to see when it was going to be over, like everyone else, because I think we all just thought that it was just something, it was an overnight, not a sensation, but it was an overnight thing, not a we're still talking about it, you know, 28 months later sort of a thing.
What was it like knowing that it was out of your control? There was nothing you could do to make things better.
I mean, utter hopelessness. It was, as a boss and a dad, you like to think that you can make anything that goes badly wrong right.
Yeah.
And there was nothing There was nothing that I could do for months that could make it go right. So not only were we at home for the first month, month and a half, the only thing that we did as a company was to pay millions of pounds back to clients who were cancelling their events. So, you know, whilst I've always taken a passing interest in cash flow, this became a lesson in day-to-day, line-by-line analysis of overhead. It was desperately difficult.
What did you end up doing to survive?
We had to cut hard and we had to cut deep. And it was terrible. I know that I had some sort of God complex at the time where I wanted somehow to keep everyone safe.
Okay.
My de facto reaction was, I'm going to save everyone.
Right.
And I think with some sage advice from, you know, one or two loved ones, it was obvious that we weren't going to be able to keep everyone safe. And so we decided in our infinite wisdom to go down to 15 members of the team.
Wow.
I spent our 20th anniversary calling and writing to 35 members of staff who I counted, you know, amongst great friends of mine, that their services were no longer required, and that they were going to be made redundant, and that if they, you know, we'd pay them redundancy, so we tried to be the best employer, that we possibly could. But that was desperately difficult, and although I'd cried lots before then, those conversations were terrible. Telling people that you really like and admire, not that they were being made redundant, but that they were being made redundant in the knowledge that there was no chance that they could get a job in the sector in which they specialised, was terrible. That was really hard. I think, you know, since I started the company, I've tried to be the best and most honest, you know, communicator that we have. You hear all of these terrible stories about, you know, companies texting their employees and just saying, you're fired. Yeah. Well, we were very keen that we were not going to be that company. We were going to tell everyone face to face. But the reason those companies do that is so that they don't have to go through the emotional roller coaster of telling people and the significant emotional toll that takes on you as a leader. Interestingly, whilst we were doing it, the government had just announced details of the furlough scheme that was designed to keep more people in the workplace. But we still, as an employer, had to pay national insurance and 10% of their salaries. And whilst it doesn't sound like a lot, against, you know, us looking at losses of 550,000 quid, everything that I had put away for a rainy day over 20 years, just those amounts looked like an expense that we could have done without rather than one that we could have done with. So we cut hard and we cut deep. Yeah. And in hindsight, we possibly could have kept one or two people more safe, but it was the right decision.
And I guess you as an employee yourself have to go home thinking, how am I going to make ends meet?
Yeah, I mean, I pay the vast majority of my income through dividends, and we'd never made a loss at AOK Events in over 20 years, and my management accounts at the end of June said that we were, you know, losing 550,000 quid.
Jesus.
So my income reduced by 3/4. All of my staff volunteered to take a 25% salary drop. And trusting me that if the opportunity presented itself, that I'd pay them back. And we had a fantastic night in the pub last July, where unexpectedly I told them that I was paying all of that money back to them, which they were obviously absolutely thrilled by. I was lucky. I got a brilliant wife who decided that she'd just work twice as hard. So she's both got a shop and a curtain making business. And it happened to be one of those niche industries that actually did quite well during COVID. Everybody was at home and
doing the
thought their curtains were a bit grotty in the downstairs toilet or spare bedroom. And so she suddenly became very, very busy. And whilst I was at home with you know, children, homeschooling.
Yeah.
She got herself to the, works on her own, got herself to her workroom every day and worked really from 8 o'clock in the evening till 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, midnight.
Blimey.
In order to make as many pairs of curtains and sell as many things as she could, you know, in her shop, in order to help contribute, you know, to the family finances. And we were forced to, you know, ask for financial help. And I'm a pretty proud guy, but asking parents and, you know, bursars and family and friends, you know, to help me in my hour of need was desperately, desperately difficult.
Going on to more serious things. So I've had severe depression twice in my life. I've actually thought about ending my own life twice, just through the stress at work. And every time it crept up on me, I did not realise I was ill as I was until it was almost too late. And now I know what signs to look out for in me, but not everyone has that insight. When did you notice that your mental health was starting to be affected?
I just started crying. Not the whole time, mm-hmm. but I found it very hard to talk to my employees about the big stuff
okay.
without the emotion just coming through to the surface, and it ending up. And when we're not talking like full Oscar-winning tears, but the crack of my throat, you know, tears in my eyes, and you know, not being able to, you know, finish sentences. And you know, that was, you know, that was really commonplace. And I think, you know, it served two purposes. Actually, crying was quite good
mm-hmm.
because it allowed me to get rid of some of the pent-up stress and anxiety that I was obviously feeling. I think it also shortcutted all of my staff into realizing that things, you know, really were bad.
Yeah.
You know, hold on, this strong leader, you know, that we've got crying. It's like, damn, you know, this is genuinely, you know, hard, you know, really hard for him. And actually, my staff knew that I was going to do everything that I possibly could,
yeah.
you know, to kind of get them out of it. And, you know, we, you know, later on, you know, kind of in the summer, we kind of hatched on a plan
yeah.
and pitched it to them, at which point they flung themselves into it with enormous bravado, and that was the kind of the start of the exit. But that probably wasn't until August when Boris announced the rule of six
yeah.
and everybody then realised that we were all going to be not working from our
yeah.
offices for the whole of the rest of the year. That's when particularly the corporate market started to call us up looking for ideas
yeah.
and we already had a huge brochure. But the period of March till really the end of July, mid-August, that seemed fanciful that might even happen.
Did you think you were depressed at the time, or were you just crying?
No, I was... what's the difference between depressed and anxious?
You tell me.
I was really anxious.
Anxiety.
I think I had terrible anxiety. I went for a two-hour walk around Wagoners Wells, near to where I live,
mm-hmm.
Every morning, rain or shine, hoping that at the end of the walk I would come back with a eureka moment. And whilst I didn't really ever come up with a eureka moment, walking definitely helped. My sleep was terrible, so I knew that I woke up, I was awake from 2 till 4:30 every morning for 4 months.
Heart
I watched
racing.
More heart racing. But that time between 2 and 4:30 in the morning, when it's dark outside, you know you've got four family members asleep, but you can't talk to them.
Nope.
There's no email, there's nothing to do. You're doom scrolling on social media.
Oh, I've been there, yes.
The BBC live feed didn't really give you any solace whatsoever. And then eventually you would yawn, and that was your body telling you that you gave yourself a chance of going back to sleep. You know, that was hard. So
it's
I started
hard,
walking longer and longer and longer in order to try and, you know, 7 miles, 8 miles, 10 miles, then cycling, you know, as well, in order to try and make myself more tired every day
yeah.
to give myself a better chance of getting a good night's
sleep. It's a horrific cycle, isn't it?
You just can't think that there's a way, you know, to get out of it, actually. It's
kind of interesting looking back, listening to you. You definitely had the physical signs of anxiety.
Thank you.
But lots of people don't recognise. You think, I'm not sleeping well, or my heart's racing, I'm a bit sick, it's just something. But actually, those are physical manifestations that so many people don't realise. So actually, your brain is saying, I'm not right.
I was enormously lucky that my wife's a brilliant listener and gives great advice. Mm-hmm. Avid Radio 4 listener as well. 24/7 practically, and you know, she listened to lots of people calling in.
Yeah.
You know, and actually I think my wife Annabelle is the most empathetic person that I know. She's been trying to teach me the skill of empathy for 25 years. I'm still failing, but she was amazingly supportive in helping me get a way through it emotionally, not strategically.
Yeah. Did she know you were ill before you did?
Yes, yes. I think if she was in this room now, she would say yes. I'm not sure if I've ever asked her that question. I think she just knew that I'm a sort of naturally quite bouncy, ebullient, jolly sort of bloke. And I was the absolute polar opposite of that for 4 months. And I'm absolutely sure that her and my sons thought I was a complete pain in the ass to have around the house. I don't think I contributed to a particularly happy family life one little bit.
And that's hard with hindsight when you realise the impact your mental health can have had, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I feel really guilty about that. But you know, I've got an amazing family who I love, and they love and they love me, and it's not turned into a problem.
Yeah.
You know, in any shape or form, we just, you know, we talk now about trying to create memories, because for 2020 none of us were able to create any memories. Yeah. There are no photos from 2020 that I'll put up in my house, because we didn't go away. I look like a, you know,
yeah,
you know,
that's so sad.
Yeah, it is sad. That's a year of my life. We're only here once.
Yeah.
So we're now trying to, you know, make up for it as much as possible and have as many holidays as we can to try and create as many great experiences, or even experiences. Even a bad experience is an experience.
It is, isn't it?
Even a bad holiday is better than not going on holiday at all. Just. I'm acutely aware of, you know, the effect that I had, and I think that I, in fact, I know that I was trying to be as resilient and strong and great a leader as possible at work. But I was not able to do that at home as well.
You can't keep the candle burning at both ends.
No.
What was your lowest point?
I think over the course of the 2020, when I was at my lowest moment, two family friends took their own lives, and to see their families torn apart was that was pretty brutal. And then I also absolutely raged that my pretty middle class friends, bankers, lawyers, they're all making a fortune and loving being at home in their lovely big houses with their lovely big swimming pools, you know, with their children. And I really, and they were good in that they would check up on me and send stuff and everything like that. And I'm very grateful for all of those moments. But that they were all embracing it, and I was living my worst, living my kind of worst nightmare, professionally and, you know, from a kind of home point of view, you know, as well. And that was, I just couldn't calculate it. I couldn't work out what to do with that information. And I thought that, you know, the work family, everything that, you know, that I'd spent, you know, nearly all of my adult years building up, you know, was going to disappear.
Did you ever think about ending it all?
What, as in ending my life? Mm. No, I never thought that. But the two people that did affected me, probably more than I've ever, you know, said to anybody else. And I think I probably, you know, bottled that up, a little bit. But I'm lucky. I've got a very, you know, wide friend circle, and we all talked about, you know, that, you know, reasonably, you know, openly.
Yeah, like a wake-up call almost.
I think so. I've always been quite an emotional bloke, so it tends to bubble over any, you know, particularly, you know, strong emotive feelings that I have, whether they're negative or positive, I end up blurting it out and saying it to someone. But I think if I'd been a, you know, of a different character and been the sort of man that, you know, tried to keep stuff in and bottle it up and be that strong and silent type, that then I think I would have struggled even more than I more than I did.
See, I am that person. I am terrible at showing my feelings. I feel like it's a sense of failure. Yeah. When I was having chemo, I would only cry when my husband was at work and I was in the shower sitting down, because I couldn't bear him seeing how hard I was finding it. Mm. And I wanted to protect him from what I was feeling.
Yeah, I tried very hard. I found I showed much more emotion to my employees than I think I did to my family.
Why do you think that was?
I felt the need to be stronger at home. Whether it's nature or nurture, I'm not entirely sure. It was, I needed perhaps to have two slightly different Alexes.
No, I get it.
And that was just kind of what happened naturally.
A lot of us want to protect the ones we love. I remember the first time I saw my dad cry as a young girl, and it floored me. It was such a shock, because he's meant to be the strong one. He was the guy that fixed everything, and if he couldn't cope, how on earth was I meant to? And I guess it's like that toxic masculinity. Why are we so hard on men who show their feelings?
Yeah, I don't know. Imposter syndrome.
Do you think?
Possibly. I do think that over the course of the last couple of years, a number of, or there's been maybe a breakdown in this, you know, I think this phrase, you know, man up, you know, not going to be anywhere near as, you know, popular, you know, as it ever has been before. And I was at a amazing conference last week where there were a whole series of speakers, some desperately difficult conversation topics around, you know, suicide and sexual abuse. And there was a guy there from a charity called CALM, which I think stands for Campaign Against Living Miserably. And one of their mantras was to try and get this public perception that one in four people suffer from mental health issues to four out of four people having mental health issues. And it's true, we all have physical health, mine pretty good, and we all have mental health.
We do.
Mine currently excellent, 2 years ago, terrible. And I think that, you know, leaders, be it leaders of companies or sports teams or anything like that, have a real responsibility to tell the people that work for them that fluctuating mental health is a day-to-day thing.
Yeah.
We have good days, we have great days, we have bad days, lousy days, and they're all absolutely acceptable. They're all absolutely, you know, commonplace. Yeah. And they should be not celebrated, but they should be normalised rather than it being an HR conversation.
Did you feel guilty that you had anxiety, that you should have been able to cope?
That's a good question. I felt guilty that I wasn't stronger.
Yeah.
That I wasn't the strongest that I could absolutely be, you know, knight on charging steed strong. Mm-hmm. Suit of armour so thick that no bullet or arrow could no. But I realise in hindsight that me being vulnerable actually was an asset, and me being, you know, impenetrable from a kind of well-being point of view actually would have been counterproductive to both family and work.
I think guilt is really common, and I know I did. I felt guilty for the patients I'd let down. When I was signed off sick the first time with depression, a woman was waiting for me to operate on her breast cancer, and I couldn't do it. And that guilt of letting people down and letting my family down and letting myself down. Why do you think we feel so guilty that mental health problems are our fault?
Pre-programmed over years and years and years. Maybe I don't think English or British culture or society does anything for...
The stiff upper lip.
Stiff upper lip. I mean, we're known for it, you know, throughout our continent, let alone, you know, the rest of the world, you know, Churchillian speeches. You know, I don't think are helpful, you know, at all. I think I felt most guilty when we started to be really successful.
That's interesting.
And there were still people that we had made redundant who were still out of work, but we weren't so successful that we could offer them their jobs back. We were just turning what I thought was a massive loss into less of a massive loss. And to us, that was, you know, there was 1 month where we made a small profit for the first time. I mean, literally everyone down the pub.
Yeah.
We have to, you know, we have to celebrate this.
Completely.
But my guilt, you know, was that we'd still made all of these people redundant, and that had affected their personal lives, that, you know, the children, everything like that.
How can I celebrate when I've ruined these people's lives? Or for me, it's often the guilt when someone dies of cancer and I don't. And you have your own bubble that you have to be able to live in, and then you compare it to the outside world, and it can be hard to find that balance, can't it?
Yeah, and you know, without trying to become philosophical, because I'm not really very philosophical, you know, there's no textbook to tell you how to cope with these situations. You kind of make it up, you know, as you go along. And, you know, whilst, you know, I have an inner circle of friends at work, you know, and outside of work, you know, my sort of friends at work were not really part of our escape. You know, none of them were that strategic, or and most of the ideas that I came up with, when I ran them past them, they didn't think they were the best ideas, but I was brave enough to kind of to do them anyway. Yeah. And I felt very alone at work trying to come up with a strategy, you know, that, you know, that got us out of there. And everybody was happy to do tasks, credit control, calling up clients to see how they were.
But
relatively
that responsibility.
Easy. But the responsibility, there was mostly an absence of responsibility. Everybody was just waiting for me, and it ended up being, you know, not a shareholder, but a, you know, a reasonably senior member of staff that strategically I worked with a lot to try and come up with a way, you know, to get out.
Right,
and then, you know, he was much younger than me, and a, you know, breath of fresh air.
It can be incredibly hard to talk about mental health issues again. When I was diagnosed, I didn't know what to do. So I went to see the GP saying, I'm feeling really unwell, but I'm fine to go to work. And he said, no, you're not. No, I am. I'm fine to operate. No, you're not. You need help. And I realised that it would take 6 months to get a phone call to decide whether I needed help. Whereas if I had cancer, I'd be there in 2 weeks. And it's really hard to know who to turn to. Did you get any outside help to help you cope when you were at your lowest?
No, and I wish I had. I think at the time I didn't necessarily articulate that I had mental health trouble. I articulated the fact that my business was going down the plug hole due to a pandemic, and I wasn't clear enough in my thinking to realise that I had, you know, anxiety or depression or well-being issues. I can see now that everybody ought to be aware of somebody that they can call discreetly or not, and for it to be normal rather than for it to be exclusive. Because when I have a bad back, I know to call my local physio up.
Yeah.
Or chiropractor, or whatever it is. But when I have a shit day at work, you just bottle it up, open a bottle of red wine, and hope that next day's better.
We still don't talk about it, do
and,
we?
And we still don't talk about it. And, you know, as I sit here now, you know, I don't know which of my best friends currently have anxiety, you know, or not. So I'm happy telling you, you know, a little bit about my story. But that hasn't affected me enough to proactively call my best mates, you know, to, well, they say, ask how are you twice, not once. You know, how, you know, really, how are you? I still don't do that. I'm going to have to do that after I've recorded.
Do they
this
know
now.
How bad you were? Have you been honest with them?
No. No, I would say, I think my friends, because of God, I'm going to make them all sound awful, and they're all absolutely wonderful, and I love them dearly. I think I articulated my pain financially. So I told everyone how bad it was financially. I never put it across emotionally.
That was the excuse.
Yeah. This is how much money we've lost now. One thing I did do, which I'm really pleased of, is I wrote all about our journey, or my journey trying to lead my company, on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And whilst everybody else was, you know, putting pictures of, you know, how much they're enjoying their, you know, walks, you know, in the countryside, and how everything was going to be better soon, I likened trying to run an event management company in COVID as, you know, watching a car crash,
yeah,
you know, unfurl in front of you. And I got literally tens of thousands of views of that. And so many people wrote, God, how refreshing it is to hear someone actually say as it is,
being
rather
honest
than have some, you know, rose-tinted glasses. So I actually used that evil thing, social media,
as therapy.
As therapy. I'm glad I said that. And I found that writing all of those words out, the desperateness of the situation, how lonely I felt trying to make decisions, how much I hoped and cared for the 15 people that we kept safe, that they were still going to have a job at the end of the year. That was my outlet.
Yeah.
And that was my therapy. So I wasn't calling the Samaritans, wasn't calling Mind, wasn't calling a, you know, psychiatrist or anything like that. I was able to get my thoughts into words, and every time I press send, I felt better.
Yeah, it's the power of sharing, and I guess realizing you're not alone and that someone else is going through what you're going through, and there is help available.
I think loneliness is the worst bit about mental health problems, and if I had to articulate, you know, the worst bit, it was that 2 till 4:30 in the morning, you know, when everybody else is asleep, and you're just left with your own thoughts and you can't talk to anyone. That's when, you know, you need, you know, if I knew that one of my friends was, you know, going through that now, I would like to think that I'd set my alarm for 2 o'clock,
yeah,
and send them a message and say, I'm awake, and I'll stay awake until you're tired, yeah, and you need to go back to sleep. Because if somebody had done that for me, that would have been amazing.
They're the scary hours, aren't they?
Oh, it's terrifying. And I'm the lucky one. I'm lucky because I'm talking about my very, you know, nice middle class event management company possibly going bust, but me probably being able to find, you know, another job.
But don't belittle it.
I'm not belittling it.
The mental health you were feeling was really real. And I think so many people blame it. I'm lucky. But actually, mental health isn't... It affects everybody. And yes, you had a lucky comeback. You were able to come... A lot of people can't. But don't belittle what you were feeling.
No, okay. I won't belittle it.
Do you know
what
I mean?
I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to say that in comparison to someone, you know, who had cancer or, yeah, you know, real,
like,
you know, abuse, or, yeah, or someone like, yeah, someone, yeah, like you, I don't feel happy in myself likening what I went through to, you know to something, yeah, that you went through. But that vulnerability, men are not good at admitting that they're feeling vulnerable, mm-hmm, and, you know, actually, you know, talking to you and, you know, being part of this podcast and showing my, you know, staff and friends and family that, you know, that being vulnerable is okay, mm-hmm, I hope is a good thing.
I'm sure there are loads of people listening who've been affected either personally or know people who've been affected by this. And again, balancing the perceived image of masculinity and, as you said, being able to be vulnerable, not feeling guilty about mental health issues. Have you got any words of advice for anyone who is where you were back then?
Marry well. that's a great start. And I think it's having the emotional intelligence, I don't like, because suddenly it makes you feel that if you're not emotionally intelligent, you can't be open, you know, and transparent with, mm-hmm, people. Crying is cool. I appreciate I haven't cried on this podcast. I'm in control with my emotions. But I do think that if you've got something that you know deep down inside is better, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved. Who of our generation wasn't told that by our parents? That literally never a truer word spoken. And you only need one really good friend to be open, you know, and transparent with. And if you can't tell everyone, if you can't tell your other half or your, you know, your directors at work, if there's one person, and it might not necessarily be the person that you thought was the person that, you know, could you would listen to. If you can find someone who will be a great listener, and if you know that now ahead of something bad happening in your life, you know, write that person's name down on your phone. If the shit hits the fan, I'm going to call, and then write down that person's name. We all have somebody in our will that if me and my wife are knocked over by a bus, who is, you know, the lawyer going to call to look after my three children?
Yeah.
Well, if we all did the same from a mental health point of view, who's my go-to person that's going to listen, have empathy, you know, and listen till I'm blue in the face? That, you know, that would be great.
Who was yours?
My wife.
Your wife.
And she was amazing, and she's, you know, still amazing now, and I'm really lucky.
I'm glad you had her. But talking about emotion, I want to talk about joy.
Great.
My podcast has a jar of joy. Now, I started this during chemo when I thought it was the end of the world, I'd be dead in a year, and I thought, right, I'm going to do something about it. So whenever something good happens, I write it on a piece of paper and I put it in a jar. And just seeing that jar build up just makes me smile whenever I'm having a down day. And it can be little, like my husband finding a fiver in a pair of trousers.
Wow.
So I want you, all my listeners, send me what's happened to them in the week, and that goes in the jar, but all my guests get to do it as well. So can you share with us something that's made you smile over the last couple of days?
I woke up on Saturday morning having had the best night's sleep I've had literally for years, 2.5 years. As usual, wife and children fast asleep, despite it being about 9:30. And I went to open the curtains in the living room and I saw a tiny blue tit that had obviously just fledged from the nest in the eaves of our roof.
Aww.
And it had bounced down the ivy and it was on the windowsill and it was squawking to its brothers and sisters. And I could hear them replicating exactly the noise that it made.
Mm-hmm.
His or her brothers or sisters made exactly the same noise. And I stared at this little bird for 30 minutes, fearful that the next door neighbour's carnivore of a cat didn't literally destroy all of my dreams in one foul swoop. But actually seeing it jump off the windowsill and fly to the hydrangea on the other side of the garden, that was joy as Mother Nature intended it. That was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful moment.
That is going in the jar.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, Alex. It's been a real honour to talk to you.
I've genuinely loved every minute. Thanks for having me.
Alex's chat really made me think. I feel like people in their 20s are gradually opening up and talking about their mental health. But for those of us in our 40s and 50s, I wonder if we find it hard because of how we were brought up. What was the impact of being told that children should be seen and not heard? And when Alex said that he talked to his work colleagues about his anxiety before he told his family, it made me realise just how toxic the traditional alpha male role model in a family can be. And that comment about not knowing whether his best friends were in a good place, I can totally relate to that. It's so easy to be caught up in your own problems that you forget to ask about other people. We can all be so busy that we don't give those we love the space to really tell us how they are. What do you think? Am I right? I must say thank you for your lovely comments about Maggie's episode. Julia said it was a lovely introduction to anyone wanting to know what therapy was like. And several people said they wished they lived near Maggie so she could treat them. I'm going to join you with that. Now, the jar of joy is almost full. This week's entries come from Jen, who had a spontaneous, long, hard hug from her son. I do envy you. Hugs were the things I missed the most when Mum had her arm amputated. We should all hug more. Go and hug someone you love, right now. And Katie Lamb found out that she didn't need chemo. That's definitely going in the jar. Mine is waking up 2 days ago to find 10 ducklings on my pond. They are so cute. Next week, I'll be talking to Eleanor Mills, founder of Noon, about how to love the middle of your life and embrace your inner queenager. Trust me, you won't want to miss it. If you enjoyed the show, get in touch and let me know, because I love reading your comments. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.